This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
group has gone to the prison and has liberated all political prisoners and military guys who are in the prison.
That's Abdu Shakur Aboud from VOA Swahili service on the latest from Comoros. Details coming up. Also, at least 12 people were killed and more than 20 others injured when a car bomb exploded today outside a restaurant in Somalia's capital. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, incumbent Azali Assoumani of Comoros on Tuesday was declared winner of the presidential election even as the opposition rejected the electoral outcome as fraudulent. Assoumani's victory with more than 60% of the vote ensured he avoided a second round against a single opponent. Mahamadou Ahamada, candidate of the leading opposition Jua Party, who received about 14%, has said he cannot recognize the results of a rigged election. Observers from three regional bodies, the African Union, the Common Market of Eastern and Southern Africa, and the African Standby Forces of the East, said on Monday the voting process was full of irregularities that led them to conclude it lacked credibility or transparency. To brief us on the latest goings-on in that troubled nation, I talked to Abdu Shakur Aboud from VOA Swahili service. I started by asking him to brief us on the arrest of a presidential hopeful, Soli Mohammed, and the status of the several demonstrators arrested at a women's protest march today.
Yes, as far as I'm concerned right now, according to sources which I've been talking to this whole morning, is that there has been some shooting at the main military camp, which is known as Kandaani, and the candidate who was number three during the elections, who has been arrested, Soli Mohammed, known as Campagnar, I understand he was sent to the military camp and some of his followers went to try and liberate him, and a fight has occurred. And what I'm understanding is that a number of people have been injured, and it's not yet clear right now who is in charge of the camp at the moment. But at the same time, a group has gone to the prison and has liberated all political prisoners and military guys who are in the prison. And one of the person who was in the prison is Faisal Abdusalam, who is a former deputy chief of staff who has been arrested for a while. And he has his followers, and I understand they're in Moroni now trying to liberate other people.
This is very interesting. The opposition seems to have flatly rejected Azali's victory of 60.7%. And as the angry mood, as you just described, threatens to spark a new political crisis. With a long history of coup d'etats and the attempts of power grabs, where do you think this thing is going? Are we heading for another coup d'etat?
It looks like, really, because what is appearing right now is that the military is divided. It's divided between the ones who are following Azali and the ones who are now following the opposition. So it's not yet clear what is happening. But the way the elections were held, the way it was, the results were being announced, the opposition are completely against it. And yesterday, actually, they named Campagnar, who was arrested, as acting president right now. They're following the way Venezuela is doing, the way we saw in Congo, where Fayulu declared himself president. And that's what angered the government, and he was arrested for that. So even today morning, there was a big demonstration of women. When you talk of 12 people arrested, I think all of them are freed now following the breakup at the prison. Those are women who came out to demonstrate, to call the Supreme Court to cancel the election results. So they wanted it canceled, but then events turned around with what happened today, and the military is in problems.
Shakur, enlighten us, if you may, on the Comoros presidency and the traditionally rotating system it has among the leaders.
Yes, what has happened is that Azali, who actually right now I'm understanding he's in one of the other island, Anjouan, he went to congratulate or he went to thank the voters for electing him. He changed the constitution. The constitution was changed in 2002 when one of the islands wanted to become independent, and a new constitution to try and bring calm in the islands.
The island of Anjouan.
Yeah, so they created this new constitution where the presidency will be in rotation. Anjouan, Mueli, and Ngazija. This time, Azali was elected in 2016 for the term of Ngazija. But then, after this long 10 years of democracy in this system, Azali called a national conference and saying, let's see what has been achieved. Is it working? And then, from that constitution, from that meeting, people, his own people said, no, it's not working. We need to change the constitution. He changed it, and that's why he called these elections. And now, because at the old constitution, the presidency was one term. With his new constitution, he's putting two terms, which means he wants to prolong his period for 10 years. So he called this
extending the term limits.
Exactly. So that's what happened right now, and that's where we are at this moment. The opposition boycotted the constitution changes because they thought it was not right, but this time they wanted to participate to stop him, because in many cases they say in Africa when opposition boycott the election, they're giving a free ride to the one who is the president. So they wanted to stop him, and that's what happened right now.
Abdushakur Aboud, thank you for your input.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
The latest update from Comoros just now is that four people have died at the military camp and seven more were injured. At least 12 people were killed and more than 20 others injured when a car bomb exploded today outside a restaurant in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. Witnesses tell VOA Somali Service the blast occurred outside the restaurant along Mak al-Mukarrama Road, Mogadishu's busiest street. One witness said the roof of the restaurant collapsed with many people inside. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the attack bore the hallmarks of the militant group Al-Shabaab, which frequently attacks hotels and restaurants in Mogadishu. Aid agencies continue the push to get aid to victims of Cyclone Idai in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. In Mozambique, the government and aid workers are rushing to set up cholera treatment centers to prevent the spread of the potentially deadly waterborne disease. Vaccination programs are being set into motion. In Zimbabwe, the United Nations is assessing the Cyclone Idai humanitarian situation in Zimbabwe as calls for the government to provide aid more quickly grow louder. Columbus Mavunga reports from the hard-hit district of Chimanimani, about 500 kilometers southeast of Harare.
At Machungwe village in Zimbabwe's Chimanimani district, the area west hit by Cyclone Idai, people wait as officials prepare food. Cornmeal has run out, but authorities say other food is being distributed. Coming here has become a daily routine for many since the disaster hit on March 16, including Susan Makuza. She takes care of five children whose parents died in the cyclone. Poverty has struck us, says Makuza. Our maize crops were swept away with the river. Our survival is at risk and we do not know what to do, she says. We came to receive food, but we were not given any and our houses went down the river. We are sleeping outside, says Makuza, adding that I was kindly asking for help. That is the same for 81-year-old Wamizai Matamande. There's really hunger here, says Matamande, because Cyclone Idai damaged our granaries. So we are frequenting this place hoping to get something like cornmeal, but I have not received anything, says Matamande. Lloyd Kasima is the acting district administrator for Chimanimani. He told United Nations officials assessing the situation that the government was aware of the villagers' struggle. He said after Cyclone Idai hit, more than 7,000 people were left homeless, while more than 40,000 people have no food.
But at the moment, the distribution is quite slow because of transport problems. But at the moment, there are some people, the Chinese contractors, who are at least trying to open our usual road. We have seen that they are making progress.
Bo Victor Niland is the Deputy Regional Director for the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund. He says UNICEF is setting up a temporary rehabilitation center at Ngangu School for children traumatized by Cyclone Idai. UNICEF is seeking aid to help Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe address children's health, sanitation, and education concerns in the wake of the cyclone.
Globally, for the three countries, it's going to be about 150 million that we're appealing. That's about the calculation at the moment. But we're also still discovering, because some of the areas are inaccessible.
Acting UN representative in Zimbabwe, Esther Muiya, says Harare is doing its best to cope given the scale of the needs.
There's still a lot of gaps. Most people lost all their food. And you know, there was an impending drought already in Manicaland. And the cyclone has actually compounded the whole situation. The waterways have been destroyed completely. People do not have clean, safe water for drinking. And that's a big priority at the moment.
The European Union has funded a World Food Programme-owned helicopter to bring in UNICEF equipment and chemicals to prevent waterborne diseases. Villagers here hope donors will soon provide funds for airlifting much-needed food to the thousands of people left struggling to survive. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chimanimani, Zimbabwe.
Maltese armed forces today took control of a tanker after migrants it had rescued had seized control of the ship. The tanker has docked in Malta carrying 108 migrants, including women and children. The migrants say they took control of the ship to keep it from returning to Libya. Italy's far-right interior minister Matteo Salvini said the vessel had been hijacked and vowed that the migrants would not be allowed to disembark in Italy. Both Italy and Malta have closed their ports to humanitarian ships that rescue migrants at sea. That has led to several standoffs as European governments argue over who will take them in. Refugee aid groups, however, criticize the European policy of returning those rescued at sea to Libya, where they say migrants are often subject to abuse such as torture and rape. The United Nations mission in Libya is preparing to hold a national conference next month to draw up a roadmap to end the Libyan crisis. About 150 delegates representing all political categories will attend. The delegates are expected to determine when to hold parliamentary and presidential elections and to try to reach decisions on a new Libyan constitution. The UN mission says that both the Government of National Accord, headed by Faiz al-Sarraj, and the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, agreed to end the transitional phase through general elections. Rhiannon Smith is the managing editor of the Libya Analysis website in London. She spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the prospect of reaching a political solution through this conference.
I think this could be a significant step forward. Problems we've seen in Libya over the previous years in terms of trying to find a political dialogue and a political solution have been that they are top-down, so implemented from the international community out or from the leadership, the sort of political leadership down, but haven't really had any impact on the ground. This format has the potential to kind of overcome some of those boundaries, bring together a wide range of Libyans and actually come up with some Libyan-led solutions that that also will work and reflect the realities on the ground. There are still many things that, that could go wrong. There are many groups that are likely to be hostile to this event potentially, but I think the fact that we've got the main actors on board, I think this could be a positive platform to really have some positive change in the near future.
The planned national conference would also determine when to hold parliamentary and presidential elections and would try to reach decisions on a new Libyan constitution. What could make or break a consensus on these important issues?
This is a very important question. So the issues that you've highlighted there are ones that have been very divisive and undecided in sort of Libyan political process for many years. So these are not issues that are going to be overcome or, you know, decided easily. That doesn't mean it's impossible, however. If I sort of go through, and so the parliamentary elections, this is probably the least controversial and actually least challenging of those aspects, because Libya has already had parliamentary elections. In theory, the current sort of elected body, which is the House of Representatives, their mandate ran out quite a long time ago. So, and you know, there is this precedent for having these kind of elections. So I think this will be the easiest one to push forward with. That said, as I mentioned there, the House of Representatives and some of the already kind of elected officials may try to prevent this from happening, because that will mean they lose their own power. So again, there will be challenges along the way. The presidential elections are probably the most controversial. Now, this is because whoever is elected as president will hold a huge amount of power. And one of the key areas of disagreement over this is how much power that individual will have. Will the president also act as the supreme commander of the army? And many people are worried that if that's the case, we could see another sort of Gaddafi figure, another dictator. And many people in Western Libya are afraid that Khalifa Haftar would take on this role. Now, there are reports that the way around is, the way that the National Conference is thinking of moving past this, is to actually have a three-person presidential council, a bit like what exists at the moment, with Haftar, Saeed Sarraj, the current prime minister, and another representative from the south of Libya, to kind of move past that issue and try and find some compromise. And finally, on the constitution, this falls into two main camps: people that want to have a constitution approved before the elections, and those that think it should wait until after. Again, this is not an easy one to solve. So there is a process at the moment. There is a draft constitution, and there is legislation to hold a referendum on that. But it's hard to see how that will happen in enough time, and many people are unhappy with the current draft, and so it's unlikely to pass. So this will be another key thorny issue. I suspect the easiest way will be to delay until after elections. But again, these are all points that they will need to discuss. So although the National Conference is positive, it's definitely a positive move, there's a lot to move past in order to have real change and implementation in the process on the ground. In order for any solution, political way forward in Libya to work and to actually bring some peace and stability to the country, it needs to have the acceptance, the participation of some of the key militias and other actors, sort of social and tribal actors on the ground. So I think the idea is that the Haftar and Sarraj are leading the way, but actually it needs the participation of all these other actors through the National Conference to be able to actually agree something that could actually work and could provide a solution for the future in Libya.
That was Rhiannon Smith with Libya Analysis in London. She was speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. Land and access to land is a source of conflict in many areas around the world. Land rights are considered by many as vital to a feeling of security for individuals and families and to economic development. The British research group Prindex looked at this issue in 33 countries, mostly in Africa, and this week released its study on opinions about land rights. The study found that about 178 million adults, and with them 117 million children, said it was likely or very likely that they would lose their homes in the coming years. The study also found that there was a difference between women and men in feelings of security about land ownership. VOA's Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with Prindex's co-director Malcolm Childrese about the report and what it could mean for development in countries in which more people are moving to cities and putting new pressures on land use.
Your study finds high levels of land insecurity, especially in Africa. Can you explain the importance of property rights to economic development and well-being?
You know, when people have security and feel secure about their property rights, they're more likely to want to invest in their homes, to make long-term investments in businesses, to do the kind of things in agriculture that lead to long-term crops and investment in soil conservation. It's that whole relationship between knowing that you can be there and get the benefits of putting effort and investment into your property.
Malcolm, your study finds regional differences in people's feelings of land security. What policies are there for governments in places where high levels of insecurity exist, such as West and Central Africa?
Of course, countries come with very different historical trajectories and different institutional historical systems around land and property rights. You know, we also see, for example, in Rwanda in Central Africa is the country that actually has the lowest rate of insecurity within this sample, and that's a country that in the last several years has implemented policies to actually document, you know, parcel by parcel, neighborhood by neighborhood, who has rights to each parcel, and then put those in a system with legal protections and a system for protecting those rights. So those are the kind of policies which really show the way to making progress on this issue.
Explain a little about some of the reasons behind the differences in property insecurity among men and women.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is actually not so much the variation that comes out by country, but what really jumps out is how much more women are concerned than men about women losing their home or land when they consider scenarios of divorce or the death of a husband.
What do you think the study did not show that needs a closer look? Give us a look ahead to possible future research.
We really want to take this down into specific cities and to be able to really pinpoint areas where the problem may be more intense and where policies could be very specifically targeted geographically or towards certain groups. I think that's a big area that we would like to go forward, and then to unpack really much more specifically the impact of specific policies and the way that they are being implemented, or in some cases where there are problems in implementing policies.
What surprised you the most about the findings of the current report?
Yeah, I think what's really most surprising is the magnitude of this problem and in the ways hiding in plain sight. That Prindex shows that about 1 in 4 adults, fears losing their property against their will around the world, and that's a really big number. And I think that the impact of that insecurity ripples through societies and economies and is holding back economic growth.
Malcolm Childrese, co-director of Prindex, a research group based in Britain that studies property rights in countries around the world. Thank you for being with us, Malcolm.
Thank you very much.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. We'll be right back.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.